Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A scarcity of lethal injection drugs has forced the state of Ohio to postpone executions since 2018. Governor Mike DeWine told the Associated Press in December that the ball is now in the court of the Ohio General Assembly.
We do have really an unofficial moratorium. There's not going to be an execution in this state unless the state legislature, changes the law.
The governor said that's unlikely in 2021. Today, we're talking about the capital punishment trends in Ohio and across the country. Andy Chow is a reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Andy.
Hi, good morning, Ann.
So why the scarcity of drugs?
Well, there's a scarcity of drugs for a number of reasons. There are several drug manufacturers that do not want to provide the drugs that they make for the purpose of executions. There are drugs that have been proven to be unsuccessful in the past. Ohio has its own history with trying to carry out executions and with reports from witnesses saying that the person being executed was struggling to breathe. That was Dennis McGuire a few years back. And then you have this issue of trying to obtain drugs, but trying not to go into contracts or make deals that could impact the state's contracts with other things when it comes to Medicaid and resources for their prisons.
Did this come on gradually? It seems like it did because the Kasich administration was kind of, full steam ahead.
Yeah. So what we've sort of seen, and I think it's really gone back to in January of 2014, like I mentioned, Dennis McGuire was set to be executed, and Ohio was using this three-drug cocktail, using a drug called midazolam. And that's sort of been the drug that's been in the spotlight for issues in the past couple of years because people don't really know what kind of happens to the human body when that drug is induced along with the other drugs that end up stopping the heart. And so back in January of 2014, like I said, witnesses reported that McGuire was struggling to breathe, having issues, and it took about 25 minutes for the execution to be completed. And from there, investigations were ongoing. There were court cases, and that really got the ball moving in a direction of where Ohio is now, where there really isn't quite an appetite among top state officials to carry out the death penalty at this point. And it kind of started there. And then it went to the court cases. And then you have people like Governor John Kasich, who wasn't really keen on carrying out executions. And then you have Governor Mike DeWine, as you heard what he said, and he has not overseen an execution during his term as governor.
He called it an unofficial moratorium. Has anyone asked him why he just doesn't call for an official moratorium?
Well, that might have to be something that's done by the legislature. Okay. Perhaps that's a thing. That has been something that's come up over the past couple of years. You have opponents of the death penalty, mostly coming from the Democratic side, saying, look, Ohio is in a position right now where it's constantly under threat of lawsuits and court cases because of questions surrounding the use of this three-drug cocktail for executions. Why not just call for a moratorium as the state continues to investigate this drug cocktail, investigate different methods? And that has not been met with too much support. And what we're sort of seeing now, Ann, is people who are against the death penalty, Republicans, Democrats, you're sort of hearing behind closed doors that this might just be the way to go. Maybe not to officially put it to a vote, but just to have this de facto moratorium continue to carry out since Ohio really doesn't have a method to do it anyway. And then it'll just take anybody who does have a strong appetite, a strong desire to carry out executions to come around and really push the issue forward.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking about the death penalty in Ohio. It hasn't been put to use since mid-2018. The overt problem is the scarcity of drugs to perform the lethal injection process. My guest right now is Andy Chow. He's a reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and he's been covering this issue. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I'm really interested in hearing from people who have changed their minds about the death penalty one way or the other, and why you have. 614-292-8513. So you could just let it go this way without an official moratorium, you know, just kind of hanging around like that, like a law does. And certainly there's many of them that just sit there. But that even not doing anything about the death penalty law in Ohio still costs taxpayers a lot of money, because people are still charged with death penalty specifications. And that means that immediately that changes the cost of a trial. Everything changes after that.
Totally right, Anne. And we have, the state has more than 120 people who are still sitting on death row, not knowing what the future might hold for them. And then, like you said, there are prosecutors in the Ohio Prosecutors Association has been wanting to keep the death penalty in play because they say it is a really good tool to have to get plea bargains, to get defendants to plea down. And so there are just several things going on. And like you said, there's a cost that comes with it too. And the other conversation that could happen here, not anytime soon, but years down the line, is the death penalty a deterrent to crime? Is it a deterrent to homicide? Many experts, many people who have studied this have said no, that the death penalty has been around for a long time and it hasn't really done much to stop somebody from committing an act of murder. And so what happens now that we are in sort of this de facto moratorium, what happens to the future of violence and what can be studied from that? And what we've seen in the past is that we see politicians sort of take an argument, take an issue that maybe has gone undiscussed, underrepresented for a while, and bring it back up. So could we see a potential primary challenger in the next few years make the death penalty a bigger issue that it hasn't been in the past because we've had the death penalty carried out in Ohio so often?
Is it still, I mean, in 2019, then House Speaker Larry Householder said Republicans were questioning Ohio's death penalty law because of the cost and the inability to find legal drugs. I mean, they're just questioning, is it worth it, the trouble that we go to? Is it still pretty much, you know, Republicans pro-death penalty, Democrats opposed anti-death penalty, or is it starting to get fuzzier than that?
I think it's starting to get fuzzier than that, Anne, and I think you make a good point, because I think there are plenty of Republicans, conservative Republicans, who don't think that the death penalty should be an option on the table, not necessarily for all sorts of reasons. And then there are also, we've seen Democrats who are pro-death penalty. We saw Ed Fitzgerald a few years ago. He was the Democratic gubernatorial nominee who was pro-execution. And so the lines are getting a little blurrier. I think another thing that we've seen over the past couple of years is that whether they believe one way or another when it comes to the death penalty, it's just not a priority. It's just not making it on their top 10 agenda.
Well, you know what I'm going to say to that? There is nothing really makes it to that agenda. But yeah. What about Ohioans writ large? I mean, what about the voters? How are the attitudes of the voters, and how is that driving the politics of it?
That's a good question. You know, I'm very hesitant to refer to polls, especially what we've seen in the past couple of years. But yeah. I think that the death penalty hasn't really, I think that we've seen, and I might be wrong, it's been a few years since I've seen a poll on it, but I think we've seen a majority of Ohioans do support the death penalty, but again, it's not an overwhelming majority, and I don't think that there is a strong support in it. I don't think it really becomes a litmus test for a voter when it comes to who they're deciding to vote for governor, for other state leaders.
I know the Prosecuting Attorneys Association, and we're going to hear from the executive director of that organization coming up later in the show, but I know that you said it, that they want the death penalty because it gives them a bargaining chip in plea bargains. Is there any other organization, any other known proponent, pro-death penalty group out there?
I haven't
seen. We have a hard time. We haven't been successful in finding them. That's why I ask.
Yeah, it's a good question. No, I haven't seen much. And, you know, it kind of goes back to the, is there a silent majority out there that because it's always been around that maybe there hasn't been many groups that have needed to advocate for it in the first place. Meanwhile, when it has been around, you heard very strongly from the opponents like Ohioans to Stop Executions who have been against it. So no, I haven't heard much in that area in the past. And again, I think another reflection of that is just this, I don't want to say unwillingness, but in the legislature, there's just not a huge drive from anybody saying, yes, let's start doing this. Let's get this together. We have seen in the past different state leaders in the House and in the Senate talk about what's it going to look like? What is a new method going to look like? And whenever it's even floated out there, it's been met with a lot of criticism, because if you're not talking about lethal injection, then, you know, you have people bringing up something like a firing squad. You have people bringing up lethal gas and even the electric chair again.
Okay. And then just getting back to the cost, is there any good idea about what it costs Ohio taxpayers to sustain this law such as it is?
You know, there are studies out there. I know that Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor oversaw a panel to look into the cost, and I know that it does get pricey. I can't remember the details of that report, but it has in the past come up to be something that does end up costing the state quite a bit of money.
And then one other issue before I let you go. In Ohio, you know, there's the big populous, quote-unquote, wealthy counties. And then there are the scarcely populated, poorer counties. The death penalty is pursued most often in those big counties. I guess Cuyahoga County was one of the biggest ones in the country a few years ago. Cincinnati or Hamilton County as well. What does that say about equal prosecution of the law across the state? It varies, doesn't it?
It does. It really comes down to, are you being treated, is an accused criminal being treated fairly between county lines? And going back to that board that the Ohio Supreme Court sort of oversaw a couple of years ago, bringing up suggestions and bringing up issues, this was one of them, that the death penalty was sought out far more in those bigger counties like Summit County, Cuyahoga, Hamilton, and not so much in these smaller counties. And so what does that do to when it comes to equal justice in the criminal justice system?
It's a constitutional issue, right?
It becomes a constitutional issue. And that actually goes back to these court cases that have stemmed from the Dennis McGuire issue that we talked about in 2014. Mm-hmm. What is going on when the lethal injection is administered, and is it cruel? Is it unusual? And for the people who are constantly seeing their execution date set and then reset and then reset, is that a form of cruel punishment as well?
Interesting. Well, Andy Chow, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's Andy Chow, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. We're going to hear from criminal justice experts. We're going to hear from the Death Penalty Information Center, the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association, and Ohioans to Stop Executions. So stay with us. And if you have a question or comment, you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can call us at 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Public opinion about the death penalty has shifted dramatically since the 1990s. Drug manufacturers don't want to be associated with the practice of lethal injection, and 10 states have ended capital punishment since 2005. Ohio's death penalty law endures, but Governor DeWine said there's an unofficial moratorium due to the scarcity of lethal injection drugs. The Ohio General Assembly appears uninterested in taking up the issue. Robert Dunham is the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. He's a nationally recognized expert on the death penalty with 25 years of experience as a capital litigator and teacher of death penalty law. Robert Dunham, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Evan Mandery is a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. His 2013 book is titled A Wild Justice, The Death and Resurrection of Capital Punishment in America. Welcome to the show, Evan Mandery.
Thanks for having me.
And Lou Tobin, Executive Director of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association. Welcome to the show, Lou Tobin.
Thanks, Ann.
So, Lou, I was talking with, Andy Chow a little earlier, and he said that what we've heard many times before is the benefit to prosecutors is the bargaining chip of death penalty in plea bargaining. Is that it?
Well, that's not it. In that, I don't think it's a benefit to prosecutors. I think the death penalty is a benefit to victims. It's a benefit to the state, and it's a benefit to public safety. And if I could just comment quickly on the argument that support for the death penalty is waning, there was an NPR PBS News Marist poll, I think from late in 2019, that said that 58% of adults overall don't support repeal. 57% of white people don't support repeal. 59% of non-whites don't support repeal. 57% of millennials, 65% of Gen Xers, and 57% of baby boomers don't support repeal of the death penalty. So this isn't just prosecutors or law enforcement saying that we need to have this on the books. There's widespread support for this. I think support tends to go up as violent crime goes up, and we're in a period right now where violent crime is going up. So I think you'll see those numbers go up even more.
Yeah, but it's still down from what it was back 25, 30 years ago.
It is, but there's still, a healthy majority of Ohioans and a healthy majority of Americans who support it as an option.
When somebody talks to you about, yes, but they can't get the drugs for death penalty, the other options at this point, there's no appetite for them. It's costing the state/counties millions and millions and millions of dollars in incarceration and also in litigation costs. What about that factor when you think, Lou Tobin, about the equation of the death penalty?
Well, look, I think there are two categories of people who raise arguments against the death penalty. There are people who have moral objections to it, one. And I think there are two people who come up with arguments that aren't really reality-based and that are intended to get people who would otherwise support the death penalty to oppose the death penalty. So I think arguments about cost, arguments about litigation, arguments about how the death penalty is applied are all things that aren't necessarily accurate.
How so?
Well, we're talking about the selective use of a punishment for the worst of the worst offenders. So Ohio, I think, has between 400 and 500 murders per year. Maybe 10% to 20% of those murderers are eligible for a death penalty specification. And I think for the last 5 or 10 years, as few as 1% of those have actually received a death specification or a death sentence. So we're talking about a very narrow category of offenders who are the worst of the worst offenders in Ohio. And we're spending all this time focusing on the cost of imposing the death penalty on four or five people who are multiple murderers, who have murdered witnesses to avoid the justice system, who have murdered children. So I think those arguments are just subterfuge.
What about the argument that the equal justice argument that if you commit the same crime in one county versus another county, the kind of charges you'll face will differ, especially when it comes to capital punishment?
Well, and again, I think that's an argument that there are ways to address that would lead to more capital punishment that opponents of the death penalty would not find satisfactory. So you could create a death penalty litigation fund that would allow prosecutors and defense attorneys in more rural counties who might not be able to afford a death penalty trial to be able to afford it. And opponents of the death penalty are still going to object to that because they're going to object to capital punishment no matter what.
Robert Dunham, what about that, the two categories that Lou Toba just mentioned, the people who morally oppose the death penalty, who may also oppose it because of these other arguments that Lou finds specious, but be that as it may, what about the categories of people who oppose the death penalty? What do we know about them?
Well, we know that people oppose the death penalty for a variety of reasons. There are those who are morally opposed to the death penalty. At this point, that's in the range of 25-30% of the American public. There are people like Joe Biden who oppose the death penalty, even though they support it in a hypothetical sense. And that's because we now have close to 50 years of experience under the current death penalty system that shows that the death penalty has been applied in a manner that's geographically arbitrary, racially discriminatory, inconsistent, and it does not get imposed upon the worst of the worst. There is a myth that we hear over and over, and Mr. Tobin himself has perpetuated that myth this morning, that suggests that because the death penalty is imposed in a very small number of cases, that shrinking the number of cases means that it's being imposed on the worst of the worst. That's about as far from the truth as you can get. The evidence consistently shows that the death penalty is imposed upon the people who have the worst representation, imposed upon people who are the most vulnerable, mentally ill, intellectually disabled, or close to intellectually disabled, have a lifetime of chronic trauma, all categories that make them less than the worst of the worst. It is imposed disproportionately in cases in which the victims are white. Once you account for the race of victim preference, the white preference in capital cases, within each category of case, we find that death penalty is disproportionately imposed upon people of color. So it doesn't fit the worst of the worst thing. People who are opposed to the death penalty have increasingly become opposed on a pro-life and pro-innocence basis. We have been able to document that there are now 174 instances of people who are wrongly convicted, wrongly sentenced to death, and later exonerated. That is one exoneration for every 8.5 executions that have been carried out in the United States. And people who, even though they may support the death penalty in the abstract, are beginning to understand that you cannot say for certain that we're going to be getting it right. And when the appeals process starts in most of those cases, prosecutors will say, courts will say, and the evidence at trial will suggest that there is overwhelming evidence of guilt for these people who actually turn out to be innocent. So we've got people who are opposed on the moral grounds, people who are opposed on the grounds that it places innocent lives at risk. There are people who are opposed on civil rights grounds. There are people who are opposed on fair process grounds because the quality of representation is so poor. And a growing number of conservatives are opposed because it does a disservice to victims' families. The single most likely outcome of a capital case, once a death sentence is imposed, is that it'll be overturned, and victims' families are dragged through this process for a very long period of time. So it's hard to categorize how many different groups are opposed to capital punishment. But I have to say that Mr. Tobin's correct. A majority of Americans still say that they support capital punishment in the abstract. A majority say that they don't want the death penalty to be repealed. But 60% told Gallup last year that they believe that a prison term of life without parole is a more appropriate punishment.
Evan, I want to get to you, but Lou Tobin, what about life without parole? What do we know about, from where you sit, how that works in the process of plea bargaining and that kind of a thing?
Well, I think Robert's right that there is a preference for life without parole over the death penalty. And I think the Gallup poll that he's referring to, if it's the same one I'm thinking of, the question was, what do you think is the most appropriate punishment for someone who commits a murder, the death penalty or life without parole? And I think to his point about talking about this in the abstract, most people are going to say life without parole is the more appropriate sentence. But when you start to get into the details, I think, of what some of these offenders who are subjected to the death penalty do, murdering 5 people, murdering 11 people and burying them in and around your house, murdering a 4-year-old child so that she can't testify as a witness against you in the murder of her mother. I think then when you start to talk about it not in the abstract, but in reality, more people are going to say that the death penalty is an appropriate option in those cases. And I think the other problem with saying that we have life without parole now, and that's an appropriate alternative to the death penalty, is that as soon as you repeal the death penalty, all of the litigation and all of the arguments that we're hearing about the death penalty are now going to shift to life without parole. And I think you're already seeing that. I was looking at a website this morning that was about ending life without parole, and the same arguments are being made about ending it now.
Hmm. Evan Mandery, the subtitle of your book, The Death and Resurrection of Capital Punishment in America. Why did it die at one point, and how was it resurrected? Why was it resurrected?
Oh, there was a pair of seminal Supreme Court cases in the early 1970s. In 1972, the Supreme Court ruled the death penalty as then practiced in America unconstitutional. It's a very divided decision, a 5-4 decision with no consensus at all as to the rationale. But a majority of the justices thought that would be the end of the death penalty. And in fact, 37 states brought the death penalty back either by creating mandatory statutes or a system of guided discretion, which was upheld in 1976 and is basically the architecture for what we have today.
Hmm. Let's see. Charles in London, you're on the air. Hi, Charles.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that a big part of this issue is the sadistic, is that death is not a punishment. Execution is a punishment. And the reason why Ohio's in the problem that it's in is because they want to have a sadistic execution. They can use nitrogen gas to cause a painless death, but advocates of the death penalty don't want the execution to be painless. And that's the problem. It's a cost-free, effective way. Have a great day. Hopefully they get rid of this. Bye.
I guess I know how you feel, Charles. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Okay, so Lou Tobin, I only have a few more minutes, and I want to talk about that, the attitude some people have that this is a sadistic pursuit. And the idea, do you see it purely? You made some pretty concrete points earlier about some of the criminals that we're talking about who are on death row, but what about that? What is your sense about what the act of an execution achieves?
Well, I think it achieves justice for the victims. Hopefully there's some deterrent effect that prevents future victimization, although I think the deterrent effect has been reduced as we've put more and more obstacles in the way of effectively implementing the death penalty. And I think to the caller's point, look, I think one of the alternatives that I've suggested and that the prosecutors have suggested, if we can't proceed with lethal injections, is the use of nitrogen gas. So I take exception to the argument that we wouldn't support that. I think we would support that as a way to maintain the death penalty as an option if it came to that.
You said the deterrent effect has been reduced as more and more obstacles are put in front of the death penalty? How so? What do you mean by that? How does that deter somebody?
Well, I think the studies have shown that the further away you get from the actual sentencing, the implementation of the sentence, the less deterrent effect that there is. So when you have people who are placed on death, who are sentenced to death and who litigate the case for 20, 25 or 30 years, as opposed to 5 or 10 years, the deterrent effect is reduced.
Because it's not in people's mind anymore.
I think that's probably right.
Robert Dunham, what do we know about that? Is there any correlation or have you seen anything in your work?
Yeah, that's nonsense. The data is clear that...
Just want a second, and it's total nonsense. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Rob.
Yeah, the we looked at 30 years of FBI data on homicides and on police killings, because if the death penalty is a deterrent, that is a powerful reason to have it. What we found when we looked at those numbers is that that murder rates are consistently higher in states that have the death penalty. Murder rates of police officers are consistently higher in states that have the death penalty. When the murder trends change nationally, when they go up in states with, without, and who recently abolished the death penalty. When they go down, the same thing happens. The death penalty has nothing to do with murder rates. It does not and never has made the public safer.
Evan?
Yeah, I mean, I think Mr. Tobin is sort of accusing, death penalty abolitionists of looking past social science evidence. Nothing that he's saying is actually based in empirical evidence. There is near unanimity, I would say unanimity in the social science community about the deterrent effect of the death penalty. It's only been observed in Texas. It's had by basically one set of researchers under very particular conditions, meaning very, very high rates of execution, and it's minuscule where it's been observed. There has been no deterrent effect observed in any other death penalty state. So the idea that it makes the public safety, it's just not based on social science evidence. If you want to say you think it brings people justice, there's no way to respond to that. But the rest of them are empirical claims that have been repeatedly refuted. By the way, I'm not even really a zealot on the death penalty. I just try to call the evidence like I see it, but that's silly.
I'm going to bring in now Jonathan Mann. He's vice chair of the Ohioans to Stop Executions. And Jonathan, from what I understand, you're also related to a victim of a murder.
Hi, Ann. Thank you for having me on the show. Yes, to clarify, I am a family member of a victim. That is correct.
Okay, so what about that victim impact of all of this? I know you're just one person and there's myriad examples, so bearing that in mind.
That is correct. I am speaking from my own experience. There are others on my board and people that I've worked with that are family members of victims and feel the same way that I do. The first thing that I'd like to say is I'd like to respond to Mr. Tobin's comments of the worst of the worst. This is a classic pro-death penalty kind of a throwaway statement. This has affected me personally. Ranking murder is offensive and callous. Murder is horrifying. It's bad across the board. You don't get to rank it. It's not a benefit for victims' family members. I can attest to that personally. This is not a conservative or a liberal issue. It's a human one. This is an ineffective, wasteful, and outdated method of justice. I've directly experienced the collateral damage of capital punishment. People like myself, my family, and others are left twisting in the wind. This process takes decades while Ohio has a cheaper, swifter alternative. Victim services are minimal and are only available when there's an active case. Many members of victims, family members of victims, don't get these resources. If we shifted away from the death penalty, we could easily provide resources to help those who need it while putting more police on the streets to stop crime. Also, media coverage of capital cases continues for decades while the crime can get played in the news over and over again, causing additional pain. This is because the media is obsessed with whether the execution will happen. The result is the public will be more familiar with the offender's name than the victim. With a life sentence, the media doesn't cover appeals as the sentence begins after conviction.
Jonathan, thanks a lot. I appreciate your call. Lou Tobin, I got to let you go, but I want you to have, the last word before we do let you go.
Yeah, thanks, Ann. You know, I would absolutely agree, and the prosecutors would agree, that all murders are heinous. But if you repeal the death penalty, and you just going back to one of the examples I talked about, if you have a guy who commits a murder who's facing life without parole for the one murder, and he murders the four-year-old child to avoid prosecution and avoid the justice system, without the death penalty, he's essentially committed that second murder with impunity because he was going to receive life without parole anyway. So, you know, yes, all murders are heinous, but when you're talking about multiple murderers and people who are committing murders to avoid justice, murdering police, murdering children, we're talking about a different level of heinousness. And I think those are the types of people that we have to preserve the death penalty for.
That's Lou Tobin. He is executive director of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association, which supports the death penalty in Ohio. We are going to continue our conversation about this topic. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The federal government on January 16 executed Dustin Hicks for his role in three 1996 murders. It was the 13th execution since the Trump administration resumed federal capital punishment just this past summer after nearly two decades of a pause. Supreme Court Associate Justice Sonia Sotomayor called the Trump execution schedule an unprecedented, quote, an unprecedented breakneck timetable of executions, end quote, reflecting growing concerns about how the death penalty is applied in the U.S. Still with us is Robert Dunham. He is executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. And Evan Mandery, he's a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. His 2013 book is titled A Wild Justice, The Death and Resurrection of Capital Punishment in America. I'm interested, Evan Mandery, about why the United States still clings to the notion of capital punishment when most of the rest of the world, certainly the Western world, doesn't. I mean, what is it about our culture? Did you look into that?
Sure, a lot of people have. Can I just I can't let that moment that just happened pass without saying something.
Sure.
I don't know how we manage this in the modern era, but I do think there's a cogent claim that somebody can make in favor of the death penalty, which I can't really disagree with. It's a retributive claim. And if you just say, I think that's what justice demands, okay, it's not my position, but I can't refute that. But every empirical claim that Mr. Tobin advanced was utterly detached from evidence. And in the structure of these debates, I mean, I think it becomes like, she said, she said, and you don't know how to manage that. I really try, and Rob's shop produces the highest quality data. And I certainly try, and whenever I've heard Rob speak, he does too, to talk about limitations of data and things that we don't know. We know that we don't know if the death penalty like doesn't deter at all, but we know if it deters about, a micron and only under the most oppressive conditions. We know that the death penalty costs more. Right. So this mantra of safety and this idea, by the way, I actually sort of as an academic disagree with your previous caller in sort of an operational sense. We can make rankings of culpability, and many people have. And when they've studied it, culpability has almost nothing to do with the people that are selected for the death penalty. What happens is there are race effects, predominantly a race of victim effect, sometime a race of defendant effect. And we know that there's an income effect, right? No rich person has ever been had the death penalty imposed against them. So this, all of these are empirical claims. And I think we're capable of differentiating between debatable empirical claims and things that are settled. I'm sorry, but that was, and it, I understand that the idea of giving balance to a debate, but boy, it's tough. To answer your question, a lot of sociologists have thought about the question of American exceptionalism, why America clings to the death penalty and other nations do not. Nobody can answer this, right? Because there's no way to run an experiment or go back in time and figure it out.
Right.
David Garland, a sociologist at NYU, has attached it very specifically to the history of lynching in the South. There's no doubt that America's particular interaction, in the most that's the most polite way I can say it, with people of color, specifically Black men in the South, has shaped the course of the death penalty in America.
And the incarceration, the whole system of incarceration writ large, right?
For sure.
Yeah. The issue of how we put people to death is of enduring interest to people. And it seems people from outside often wonder, Robert Dunham, why is this so hard to figure out? What's the calculation that we consider when we do that? And, you know, at what point, what changes over time to make us say lynching, you know, by hanging is untenable, or the electric chair, or, you know, the gas chamber, or whatever it might be?
Well, I think that there are two different things that are at play. One is people who are interested in the death penalty as a matter of carrying out the law. And the people who are genuinely interested in the death penalty as a matter of carrying out the law are attempting to do so in the least inhumane way possible. The other is the direct descendant of slavery, lynching, and Jim Crow, where the purpose of the punishment is to be as painful as possible. That's why we saw in the lynchings that people don't just get hanged; they get dismembered, they get burned, and so forth. And we see in some of the rhetoric against the prisoners who are arguing that their method of execution is unconstitutional, you see some proponents of execution talking about, well, what he or she did to the victim was so bad, we should be doing it in any way we want. But what we come to in terms of applying the law is that states, generally speaking, have been trying to move to less inhumane ways of carrying out executions.
And that's more about our sensibilities as the survivors of an execution, as the people who watch or stand by.
That's right. But I think that, you know, you can't say that the state is operating in bad faith by choosing a method of execution that turns out to be torturous. When states moved to electrocution, they did so under the mistaken belief that it was going to be less painful than hanging was. When they moved to lethal injection, it was after some really gruesome electric chair botched executions, after really painful botched gas chamber executions. And everybody thought at the time that that was a relatively peaceful way of putting a prisoner to death. But we now have autopsy results from more than 200 lethal injection executions that show that it is a gruesome process. That 84% of the prisoners have what's called pulmonary edema, fluid buildup in the lungs. About half of them have froth that comes out of the lungs and comes up into the airways. When it's a three-drug protocol, the system that Ohio uses when you have a chemical like potassium chloride as the killing drug, that's been akin, it's been called like being chemically burned at the stake. And the first drug doesn't knock out the prisoner, make them insensate. So it has been described by a judge, federal judge in Ohio, as a sensation of waterboarding, suffocation, and chemical fire. We now know that. And so there is no excuse to continue with those kinds of methods of execution. The problem legislators have is that the public hates all the other methods.
I was talking earlier, Evan Mandery, about, you know, Lou Tobin of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association said, gave me the statistics about support for it. And I said, yeah, but it's a lot less than it used to be. I mean, it is what it is. He's talking about the majorities and whatever poll he's citing. But what do we really know about how people really feel about the death penalty in the United States? Is it something that so many of us have just grown up with generation after generation, and it's just part of who we are?
Well, your basic premise is correct. Support for the death penalty has dramatically declined over the past 20 years. So I don't know whether he was citing a particular Ohio study.
It's declined, but he was saying it's still a majority support in different groups. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I mean, it's bare majority now, right? We know that how you ask the question makes a huge difference. So I don't think what Rob cited was irrelevant. It's actually the essence of the question, right? If we know what the alternatives are, do we want to put those in front of people or not? And we have again, you can't run an experiment, so you don't know for sure, but, you know, we have a decent sense of what it is that's animating the decline in support for the death penalty. We certainly know that death penalty salience is greatly diminished. So candidates aren't running on pro-death penalty platforms anymore.
So what do we know about the states and how they managed to ban the death penalty? 10 states since 10 or 15 states since 2005. What were the machinations there that were different than, say, in Ohio?
Rob, you want to go?
Rob Dunham?
Well, it's interesting. There are a couple of different patterns. In many of the states, what's happened is, and we're seeing this across the country, the death penalty was being employed less and less. So it was being rejected by juries, and death row was shrinking because cases were being overturned. And then there was some kind of scandal. In Illinois, for example, the police torture in Chicago, police were torturing people into falsely confessing, and Illinois discovered that they had exonerated more people than they had executed. The pattern tends to be the death penalty is being used less, and then the public realizes when they haven't had executions that it hasn't changed things. It's no different, and that eliminates a lot of the political opposition because it's hard to pander on crime when the crime is down.
Evan Mandery?
Well, I was just going to say one of the Death Penalty Information Center's best studies is one that shows that when you look at the death penalty in America, a handful of prosecutors, a handful of counties are producing a majority of the sentences. So when you ask that question about the political reality, I'm sorry, I don't really think I'm overstating this. In the academic community and the practitioner community, there's no sense that the death penalty does any good, right? We know that. We know it does significant harm and it creates lots of risks. So the question is why, in light of overwhelming evidence that something doesn't work from a standpoint of public policy, are we retaining it? And I actually think you saw that this morning. There is a political pathway in America for people who are running on law and order platforms, which really, you know, it's just a mantra. It's not greatly connected to any evidence about what actually makes people safe in America. And it sounds appealing. They make vague evidentiary claims or actually impugn the motivations of people who make contrary claims, which I actually think are, you know, based on actual study. And it's very, very tough. That's it. The death penalty in the United States will end. It will end. It's just a question of whether it ends while Rob and I are still on the planet or afterwards. But Texas, the Texases of the world, and the Lou Tobins of the world will be dragged kicking and screaming by hanging on by their fingernails into the 21st century. And that's the hurdle we have to get over.
We're just about out of time, but Evan, I'm interested in what your thoughts are. Will it peter out or will it be a fiat
it's petering.
It is petering out at this point.
Petering dramatically.
Whether it's in our lifetimes. Question. Yeah. Right. Okay. All right. Well, Evan Manderly, I really appreciate your time. I'm sorry, Mandery. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us. This is great.
You bet. Evan Manderly is a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. His 2013 book is titled A Wild Justice, The Death and Resurrection of Capital Punishment in America. And of course, Robert Dunham, as always, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Robert Dunham is Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. That's it for now. Thank you so much for your attention. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.